Welcome to the South America Files from These Football Times, brought to you by Manscaped. Get 20% off Manscaped products by quoting TFT20.
Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the South America Files. Well, actually, it's not just any other edition. It's episode 10. It's the final edition, and it's probably the most eagerly anticipated, arguably the most talking points. The darkest and the brightest is probably what I'll also throw in there as well. And we are traveling, or we end our journey, should I say, in Argentina. But before we get started, first of all, Gary, welcome. We finally got there. It's taken a while to get to Argentina.
Yeah, the series has been fantastic. We started with a great South American country. We're finishing with one as well. And this is going to be a fantastic episode. And having somebody as knowledgeable as Peter Long is going to be we say this so many times when we have, you know, expert guests on, that, you know, we think we know a little bit about football. And when we have an expert guest, we know really how little we actually knew about football.
It's usually after the first question when you start. So how did football start in Argentina? And then that's
another school day, mate. Yeah, another school day.
Stephen, welcome. Enjoyed your trip. It's been about a 6-month trip, this one. Your 6-month trip around South America.
It has. It's been an elongated one, but it's been a damn good one, though.
Learned a lot.
Oh, so much. Yeah, it's just been a huge amount of educational fun, basically. And massively looking forward to this one tonight.
And then obviously, finally, Pete, the tour guide to end all tour guides for a trip around South America. You managed to drag all three of us around. You've certainly exponentially increased my knowledge, shall we say, on South American football. And you've brought us safely to Argentina. Where does this country rank for you with regards, sort of, not so much favourite, but with regards interest in relation to football?
I think, you know, Argentina is, I mean, in my kind of academic field, Argentina is the one that's been written about the most. I mean, there are some really incredible scholars in Latin America and predominantly in Argentina, actually, who've written a lot of brilliant stuff about Argentine football and Latin American football more generally. I mean, I'm thinking about people like Pablo Alabarces, Eduardo Archetti, who a lot of my research in terms of, I suppose, theoretical perspectives builds on what they started off by writing about Argentinian football and its links to nation and nation building and national identity and culture. So I think that, you know, in terms of, for that as a kind of professional, you know, academic inverted commas, you know, football lover who, you know, uses posh words to discuss football, basically, it's really up there. And I think that one of the things that I really started out trying to do, you know, help with my supervisor, you know, and building on the standing on the shoulders of giants who've written about Argentinian Brazilian football, was trying originally understand how these concepts could be applied to, you know, Colombia in my particular case. So I mean, Argentina is fascinating. You know, football is so entwined in its national identity, in its culture. So it's really, you know, it's really fascinating to deal with the history, the politics, the issues, the figures, the way it kind of is so infused in culture, and it's so representative to, it's almost like the perfect example for the rest of the continent of how important football really is in South America.
It's a great line. Stephen, I was just about to come to you there with your sort of opening perspectives on Argentinian football before we have them rewired by Pete and told how we actually need to start looking at Argentinian football. But before we do, to me, Argentinian football is like use the Star Wars analogy because I know you'll be able to relate to it. It's like the dark side. If you have Brazil as the rebel alliance, and then you have, for me, you have Argentina as sort of as the empire, and they seem to be the dark side of South American football.
Yes, they're often, certainly from a British perspective, seen as kind of like the classic Hanna-Barbera, you know, cartoon villain almost. And you know, so, but I think so much of it is massively undeserved. they hold a bizarre kind of position, really, is that they're so dominant in South America, but people will scan across the history of football and Brazil absorbs so much light, draws so much attention. And then you've got to look at the earlier dominance of Uruguay and how well Uruguay have done in the South American Championship, Copa America, and Argentina have kind of gone toe-to-toe for them. But they were late bloomers on the international scene. Yes, they reached the very first World Cup final, but it wasn't until 1978 that the first World Cup came for them. And even then, always shrouded in a little bit of controversy, shall we say. until they win in 86, and there's an unquote, but even then, the win in 86, it tends to be shrouded because of the hand of God. So everything has this kind of light and dark when it comes to the Argentinian national side. Yet you look at their clubs are just metronomic. Independiente, the most successful team in the history of the Copa Libertadores, four of the most five successful clubs in that tournament are Argentinian. Eight different winners of the Copa Libertadores, 10 different finalists, and a collection of teams that have won the Sudamericana from kind of nowhere, really. From the likes of Arsenal and Tigre. There's so many facets to Argentinian club football that is absolutely fascinating, and that's kind of like across the broader spectrum of the continent. Let alone the parochial spats between your likes of River Plate versus Boca Juniors and every other rivalry between them. Rosario's sense of trying to put themselves in there and on the map as well. There's so much colour and so much such a massive sliding scale when it comes to that Argentinian game that it's fascinating to me.
Obviously, Gary, your sort of early thoughts and well, not early thoughts, but your perceptions and thoughts on Argentina, but also, and this is something we'll get into sort of later on when we get around to my favourite question, but do you think football in Argentina actually dominates its culture or permeates more of its culture than perhaps even in Brazil?
I guess viewing from a distance, I would say yes. I mean, people probably give us a more sort of definitive answer to that question. But I think with Argentinian club football as well, there's so many more famous names, or often infamous names, that are sort of part of the lexicon of football, European football. Your Boca, Estudiantes, Newell's, San Lorenzo, River Plate, and we're some Brazilian clubs as well. But there's that little bit of magic about Argentinian club football and the passion that it engenders, and I'm sure that sort of seeps into the society as a whole. And it might be too simplistic to say that football allows Argentina to define itself on the international stage. But I'm sure to some extent it does, because it's one of the situations, it's one of the scenarios where Argentina can make a statement of its greatness, its quality, its proficiency, its ability to compete with the very best in the world.
I guess, like we say, Pete, this is probably where I'll now learn probably a lifetime worth of history and politics in the next sort of 10 minutes. But, as always, to sort of set the scene, it's all about the very early development of football in Argentina. And I think what has surprised me has been, and something that I've learned and taken from this series, is how it's not been such almost a lazy preconception, probably on my part, that the Europeans brought it across and that was it, and they got on with it. Each nation that we've been to, we've had this sort of, yes, there's been common themes and strands, but there's certainly, it's never been as simple or as straightforward as I sort of thought it was. So I guess, the origins of the game in Argentina, the where's, the who's and the how's and the why's, if you don't mind.
Sure. So, Argentina is, I suppose, where a lot of football in South America really starts. Where it kind of diffuses out. A lot of the influences for the rest of the continent come from Argentina. And that's really because Argentina, I suppose we could add Uruguay and Montevideo particularly, that the River Plate is the scene of a lot of commercial interest for Great Britain. As early as 1807, before Argentina becomes independent, Great Britain has kind of launched a putative raiding party to try and take over Buenos Aires and River Plate, seeing its kind of economic potential. But, you know, Britain really does establish an economic kind of informal empire, you know, in Argentina, in Uruguay. To the extent, actually, it's worth knowing that there are 40,000 Brits living in Argentina by 1890. So that gives you an idea of how many British people are going to Argentina. It sounds, you know, when you think about the amount that we're going to India or the rest of the continent, Argentina isn't really particularly far behind. And I suppose that, again, we've discussed it in various other podcasts, that it's not football that hits South America, hits Argentina first, it's cricket. In 1831, the Buenos Aires Cricket Club's founded. And these kind of cricket clubs that begin to have games, become centres of leisure for British people. And places where, you know, sports will start to be played. I mean, polo is another sport that's very important, horse racing, other activities as well. So that's there first. But in 1867, when I suppose really trade between Britain and the River Plate, you know, particularly Buenos Aires, is really kicking off. The Football Association laws of the games are sent to the editor of The Standard in Buenos Aires, which is an English language newspaper, to a guy called Edward Mulhall. And then Buenos Aires Football Club is founded in the same year by Thomas Hogg, James Hogg and William Held. And there's an announcement on the 6th of May in 1867 asking if people would like to play football, with, you know, the two words separated, obviously. You know, and they're going to play on cricket grounds during the winter when, you know, they can't be playing cricket. And the first game is played between the Blancos against the Rojos, the Reds against the Whites. But then this is a bit of a false start. Rugby seems to take over for that particular club anyway. There's the kind of the next real, the founding father is Alexander Watson Hutton, who's a Scot. He arrives to teach at St Andrew's Scottish School, but then founds his own, ironically, his English high school. And he's one of these people that really believes in kind of muscular Christianity. He's very heavily influenced by that. He's very influenced by the ideas of PE and sport being part of the curriculum. And it's in that school where football really takes off. And it's interesting to note that actually before this, in 1878, a Spanish language newspaper called El Nacional, The National, had spotted that football was starting to be played and said, this English game, it will not be long until we get used to it. And 100 years later, you know, they're winning the World Cup. So I suppose that's where it starts. It starts in schools. It starts in, you know, in expat British communities. The first proper game played under FA rules is in 1887. And again, it's mostly the British that are playing it. There are football matches played between Buenos Aires and Montevideo, the kind of Brits between both cities, to celebrate Queen Victoria's birthday every year, I think until 1894. And then actually what makes, I suppose, Argentina very special is that the first championship anywhere in the world, apart from the UK, the first league is created in 1891. That particular iteration didn't last very long. But in 1893, the second championship does start, which will take hold, which is the kind of seen as being the founding father, I suppose, of, you know, of the Argentinian Football League. And the first winners are Lomas Athletic Club. Again, this is very much a British team. In fact, they were kind of made up of old boys of Bedford School who were living in Buenos Aires. So again, these kind of links with the public school system. Gradually, I suppose, you know, the start, you know, this kind of influence of British clubs, British teams, starts to filter down into the general public. There is the first match between Argentinos against Britannicos, Argentinians against British people, is played in 1894. And, you know, I suppose, it's really the first, I suppose, 10, 15 years are dominated by the British, and particularly a club called Alumni, who were former students of the high school that was set up by Alexander Watson Hutton. And in this period of dominance by Alumni, we start getting the first British sides touring South America. And, of course, the greatest team of all of them are the first two Argentina, and that, of course, is Southampton, you know, one of the greatest British teams there's ever been. I mean, I like to say, as you know, that Southampton are the founding fathers of South American football, to the extent that the impact that they created, I mean, you know, they haven't talked about Southampton like this since, but apparently in 1904, a British paper said, magnificent work with head and feet, their skillful blending of brains and boots. was hugely impressive. But one of the main things that I think is really important that I just will kind of, I'll finish on this bit, is that the fact that the nation is very present as soon as these, you know, as soon as English tides start to come over, because the president is going to watch these games. The president, Roca, is watching Southampton playing against some of the Argentinian teams. The Argentinians almost have this adversary of the British. You know, they're trying to be better than the British football players that are playing in Argentina. They're trying to be better than the English football teams that come over, first Southampton, then Nottingham Forest. Then we've got Tottenham Hotspur, Everton, Swindon, Exeter. And so this kind of rivalry between Argentina and Britain starts really almost in the founding days of Argentina seeing Britain as its football father. And of course, there is this kind of football parasite where you've got to be better than your father to get this kind of sense of achievement of becoming great. And it all starts in this kind of period. And it's seen as being really important, this kind of creolization of game, the making of the game Argentinian, to kind of supplant the British influence and then prove that they can be better about it. So I suppose that's a quick kind of potted history of how it begins.
That'll do me. Thanks very much. up to speed now. Stephen, I'll come to you then with this one. Obviously, you know, as Pete's mentioned there, you know, we've had it before with cricket clubs and, you know, and sort of the traditional sports. But, you know, why do you think it was that sort of football took the foothold? You know, cricket had obviously been there, you know, a lot longer. And Pete mentioned, I think, was it 1830, did you say, Pete?
1831, I think it was.
Yeah, so cricket club, yeah. You know, cricket has an opportunity, it has time to get embedded in the sort of Argentine sport, South America. What is it for that managed to sort of push away some of those other traditional sports? Yes, they have the Pumas and the rugby union team, but even then it's not, you know, they're not a major power in terms of rugby union. But, you know, why football above all else?
I think for football, it just comes down to pure accessibility. And the concept that, you know, you can be street games and games over the field, we all know as kids ourselves, there are no restrictions on the numbers of people that can play. You know, just one versus one is a football match, as is 25 versus 25. All you need is one ball and something that represents goalposts at either end. And you've got a football match, and that can take place absolutely anywhere. Something with cricket, you know, there's a need for equipment. There's a sense of not just the social aspect of it, and a sport like cricket and a sport like polo is an upwardly mobile, and it is a class divided sport. Football never has been. You know, football's class divides tend to be within the clubs that are formed. You know, there will be clubs from an upper-class area of a city and seen as kind of like the well-to-do club. Then you will have the working-class club, you know, a club by the docks, or, you know, that represents a certain, you know, part of a community. But football is just massively accessible. You know, it doesn't even have to be a football, you know, kick a tin can around, you know, a bundled-up rag, you know, taped up or anything like that. Anything that can be kicked, you know, it's a football match. And it is just purely the sense of accessibility, and that you can set up a football match virtually anywhere.
I get, you know, like you say, it's one of the simplest sports in the world, I guess, to play, which makes it incredibly accessible.
But within that, it also breaks that barrier down. It breaks the class divides down. You know, it's a sport that can, you know, attract and be magnetised by absolutely anyone. You know, from the you know, the highest person in the country to the lowest person in the country. You know, it's a great leveler.
And I think it challenges those social boundaries and those conventions as well. It is that kind of upward mobility that football does allow. That, you know, the kid on the street, the pibe del potrero in the typical kind of Argentine, you know, parlance, this kid on the waste ground can become the greatest hero of a nation. And that kind of, you know, this a continent where for so long so many have been sat so downtrodden. You know, football offers this kind of route of resistance. And I think that, you know, you know, a lot of football fans talk about aguante, resistance, you know, struggling, keeping on fighting. And I think that's very kind of inherent in the way that football is seen as being, you know, a sport, first of all, of the lower classes, but also offers that whole, you know, challenge to authority, a challenge to the system, you know, the machine that somehow dictates the rest of their lives.
One of the things, I'm going to come to you, Gary, because I think this is your sort of question. And one thing that sort of Pete mentioned towards the end about, you know, the president being present at those very early games between, you know, when English clubs came across. And I guess, I suppose the legitimization by political forces or political parties or ruling political leader, I guess, is another factor that sort of almost reinforces the importance of the game as such.
Yeah, I guess so. I guess, you know, I mean, we've looked at sort of lots of South American, well, you know, the South American countries that play football in this series, and not even looking further afield, you know, cricket took a hold in Asia, India, Pakistan, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa. And, you know, polo is a sort of a fairly high-class sport. You know, it's the upper classes. You need a perishing horse, for God's sake, otherwise you can't play. And, you know, as Stevie mentioned, football is more, a game played by the street vagabonds. You know, you play with a stone, you can play with a rolled-up newspaper, whatever. And, you know, to say that the president attended a game, you know, just lend a legitimacy that perhaps might not otherwise be there. And, Argentina, you know, Peter will correct me if I'm wrong here, but Argentina was probably, of all the South American country, had a leaning towards Europe rather than to the rest of South America, and wanted to legitimise itself in European terms.
It's a great point, and there's a couple of things that I sort of want, obviously, I want to ask you, Pete. But when I ask this, the question about obviously how it permeates through the culture, I'm hoping that some of the questions will get answered. But I've got quite a few waiting for you, just in case you don't cover everything. But in terms of its importance, you know, once you see like the footholds there, the establishments there, and then, you know, as you finished off with your bit in the early history, it's about that sort of superseding the sort of the founders of the game, the people who brought the game to you. You know, can you be better than them? There, you know, can you exceed what they can achieve? So in terms of its importance culturally, and to Argentina's identity, and the guys mentioned a bit about that at the beginning as well. You know, I guess, you know, like we said at the start, football just, to me, just seems to permeate right through the country.
Yeah, I mean, it completely does. It really does. I think that for a long time, or for, you know, for the first several decades, football was very much a Buenos Aires phenomenon. There were clubs in Rosario away from, you know, Buenos Aires. But, I mean, football for a long time in Argentina was the province of Buenos Aires and Greater Buenos Aires. But it still manages to transmit away from that kind of initial hub and, you know, infuse the whole country with this incredible passion. And I think one of the reasons it does this is kind of a little bit to what I was saying about the fact that it becomes a national issue very early. You know, I think that when South Americans tend to play football, you know, and Gary's already mentioned this, the nation is very present. It's the way it confronts the, you know, the rest of the world. And the nation is there when Argentina start playing football, and originally against, for example, the British clubs, where it becomes seen as being Argentina versus Britain. And increasingly so when it's not really, you know, the Brothers Brown of the alumni club, but increasingly, Argentinian names that are playing against these foreign stars. But also the Argentinian nation is present playing against Uruguay. There are very common games against, you know, clubs in Montevideo, and then Argentina versus Uruguay. And the nation is part of this. It becomes prestige. It becomes important. It becomes a way in which Argentina is judging itself. And again, as the other guys have talked about, this idea of modernization, of seeing itself as being important, of looking towards Europe and saying, we can be like this as well. Football is part of this cultural improvement of the nation, or sport is anyway. And I think that that matters. And I think that this kind of importance of sport is as being important to the people, and therefore being important to the nation, is very much reported on by the very vibrant newspaper scene, and particularly by what was arguably the most important South American magazine of the century, really, El Gráfico, which has a huge impact in Argentina, but also in the rest of the continent, because this magazine travels, you know, around the continent, and people are reading about these great Argentinian stars, and, you know, and football and why it matters. And this magazine, with a guy called Boro Cotto, who was actually a Uruguayan journalist. He wrote very, very powerfully about how the Argentine identity was constructed through football and how it was different from other countries, particularly Britain. You know, there is this idea of the kind of industrial north, this kind of machine-like fitness, you know, everything kind of being in order. But then you have, he discusses this idea of the Argentine, this kind of skill, the flair, the individuality, the kind of Latin contingent. And that kind of construction isn't just made of, you know, the kind of the Argentinians that have been there for, well, I suppose, you know, grown up, you know, as seen themselves as Argentinians since the colonial era and independence, but also as a way of integrating a lot of the Spanish and Italian immigrants who had come, you know, looking for work at the end of the, you know, 19th and 20th century. This construction included them as well. So these ideas of how important football was, you know, are, you know, grow through the importance of football, through the importance of the barrios, where the football club becomes the social space for workers in Avellaneda, in, you know, the areas where Huracan play or Atalanta play, or, you know, all the various citizens. It becomes a way of integrating people into that society. Football is this kind of melding, you know, this place where, you know, Buenos Aires and Argentina is kind of formed at a kind of low level. And then I suppose when they have success, you know, when, you know, the Boca Juniors travel to Europe in 1925 to represent not only Boca Juniors, but also Argentina, this becomes a really significant moment for the nation. It's only 21 years after Sampson come, but Boca Juniors are now going to Europe and playing against the best teams in Europe, following obviously the example of Uruguay in the 1924 Olympics. So I suppose that's where it starts. You know, football is very much there in the way that the Argentine identity is conceived. It's there being how Argentina competes on a kind of global level in different ways. And this is only exacerbated by, you know, the 1928 Olympics, first of all, the 1930 World Cup in Uruguay. And then, you know, increasingly by a series of presidents, for example, Perón, who makes sport a really important facet of the way that it creates men, it creates citizens for the nation. So it all starts, and it's just kind of because of these stories and the myths of the great players of the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, these myths grow, these stories become entwined with a national idea of heroes and stories of greatness of Argentina that ignore some of the ignominies of the past. So I hope that's kind of, you know, answer a couple of questions.
Yep, it's great. I've still got one, but I might throw it to Gary yet. I haven't decided. just, Steve Pugh, it's interesting, as Pete mentioned there about, I made a note of it here, that sort of, you know, Argentine, you know, identity or society was almost constructed through football, you know, and the people have written about it. And I suppose, you know, do you think that the same exists in this country? I'm not saying perhaps earlier, but to me, that to me, football seems to dominate culture in our country now more than ever before, I think.
In this country, I think football's always been, it's always defined the working classes, but I think it's just swept further than that now into a wider consciousness. What I find interesting, what Pete was saying, is how there was almost this paternal relationship with Britain and football, that propensity to try and test themselves against British teams and you know, the English national team eventually, which ties into the South American psyche. When we look back at how we've talked about the likes of Chile and being that, you know, a very good football playing nation that has this sense of superiority over the likes of Paraguay and your Ecuadors and even the likes of Peru, but not quite seeing themselves as the almost like the stablemates or level of the Brazilians and the Argentinians and the Uruguayans. So in a way, Argentina are displaying this to Britain almost to say, look, they're striving in a way that other nations in South America don't, to say, look, we can chase you and we can match you eventually, and we will come and we will beat you eventually. So this kind of like goes against some of the other South American notions of saying, yeah, Argentina, Brazil and Uruguay, they're always going to be better than we are, but we'll be the next best behind them. So there's, and that ties into the looking out towards Europe. So it's that concept we've said before about certain places, parts of the world where they will look to the sea, they will look globally rather than to the hills and inland, and they will look for their inspiration and their goals elsewhere. So when we go back to the original question, is that in Britain, it's almost like, no, there isn't that chase to catch up with anyone else or to beat a bigger brother or a bigger sibling or the paternal father, because, you know, this is purportedly, you know, the birthplace of the game. Britain's problem is that it's other parts of the world has taken that game on and been better than they have been at it. So they've got to kind of like turn that around and try and catch up with the people who have taken their game and say, look, no, here's a better way of playing it. Within that, you know, the British psyche will always remain rooted within its football, but it will also always have its hotbeds, and I think every nation will be like that. You know, there'll always be certain areas of a nation where football is just a pastime, yet in other parts of it, you know, in other cities, it will be absolutely everything. And I don't think Britain is going to be any different to any other football-loving nation in that respect.
That's fair enough. That's a good answer. I'll take that. Gary, it was interesting, you know, that Pete was saying there at the end, sort of these, you know, these figures from the very early days of Argentina, and how they become almost mythical figures whose stories seem to sort of grow and grow. And I guess, you know, from certainly that I've picked up as we've gone through this, you know, there's been some incredible stories of players, you know, players that I'd never heard of, but players who sort of almost transform the game or take the game to the next level. But not in a contemporary way, like we've seen through maybe Johan Cruyff or Guardiola, you know, people like that. These are people who took the game on at the very early stages. And obviously there's no YouTube, there's no, you know, there's very little documentation of the newspaper reports, but sort of the figures from the early parts of South American football, the early parts of the history of South American football, almost seem to be like fairy tale figures now. They are almost mythical characters rather than real people.
Yeah, I guess so. And I think, you know, whenever you lack facts, you lack evidence, then the myths grow around them, and they sort of, you know, the rap exploits, and they increase the sort of celebrity of these sort of guys. And, you know, I mean, I wouldn't pretend to sort of be able to quote four or five players that Pete could, I'm sure, could quote. But, you know, you have to have somebody who sets the trend and allows the sport to grow within that country and becomes the heroes of that time. And I'm sure Argentina was no different. As I say, I'm not sort of knowledgeable enough to quote the names of these guys, but I'm sure there must have been, you know, the people that, you know, in England we would look at. I mean, okay, we could just go back and look at people like Di Stefano, perhaps in the 50s, and Ratin in the 60s. But, you know, even before that, I'm sure there were people who set trends going that allowed Argentina to produce their own identity on the world football scene. And, you know, Argentina, you know, is probably, I mean, you know, I'll let Peter correct me if I'm wrong here, but he's probably almost unique in South American countries that defines himself not against South American countries, but almost against the European imperial overlords. And when they have success against a European team, it means more than perhaps putting Brazil aside, than it beating other South American teams. But, you know, when they beat, you know, Spain or England or, you know, or perhaps Portugal, who were sort of imperial powers in South America, it perhaps means a little bit more because they, you know, yeah, this is your, it might be your game, but we're better than you at them.
I mean, just one thing, Pete, I want to ask before we move on. You know, you mentioned obviously Uruguay, you know, when we did the Uruguay episode, you know, and that absolute dominance of that very early Uruguay side with the Olympics and the World Cups. And obviously Argentina come close early, But what, you might not know the answer, but what was the subtle difference that allowed Uruguay to become this early superpower and Argentina? I mean, obviously, like, as Steve mentioned, you know, it takes Argentina all the way to 1978 to win a World Cup. You know, Uruguay are there right at the beginning, you know, right at the beginning of the tournament. But I guess, you know, listening to what you were saying about, you know, the establishment of competition, the establishment of teams and the embracing of the game, it could easily have been Argentina. And I just wonder what that subtle difference was as to why it wasn't.
Yeah, I mean, it probably should have been Argentina. Argentina were, if you, I think, I haven't got the stats to hand, but, you know, they would probably be, have beaten Uruguay more than Uruguay had beaten them by, you know, by, for example, 1924, when Uruguay first won the Olympics. I suppose that one of the biggest reasons why it wasn't Argentina is that Argentina didn't go. It might just be that, the fact that Argentina, that there was a lot of factionalism at the time between the leagues, led to, you know, a dispute, led to there not being a team sent to participate in those Olympics that Uruguay ended up winning. And it so infuriated Argentina that Uruguay would win, when they thought, well, no, we should, because it was seen as the kind of World Cup at the time. That was the idea. You know, Uruguay was suddenly seen as being the best team in the world, apart from the great British professionals who weren't there. But Argentina actually immediately, as soon as Uruguay won, challenged them to the game, saying, this should be us. You know, we're better than them. And there was a kind of a best of two series played in Montevideo and then in Buenos Aires that led to, you know, one of the earliest incidences of mass kind of fan problems. I think there was something like 52,000 people, which were in a ground that had capacity of 40,000 in Argentina. The match had to be cancelled due to kind of people, you know, fans spilling onto the pitch. And then actually this was the start of the fences, you know, the famous fences of Argentinian football with, you know, you see the fans kind of, you know, climbing up 10 metres in the air, kind of, you know, hanging off the wiring, cheering on the fans. That's where it started in 1924, but because Argentina thought they should be better than Uruguay. I think that, why did it happen? Why did it not become Argentina? It probably is something to do with a little bit of that, maybe the underdog spirit, the fact that Argentina saw themselves as being superior. I mean, you know, Steve and Gary have both correctly said that Argentina sees itself as being superior to the rest of South America. You know, they see themselves being more cultured, more, you know, even racially pure. I mean, I think it's, I can't remember, it's Boca Juniors or River Plate, I can't remember which one, often almost insult other fans as being Bolivian. You know, that gives you an idea of this kind of superiority complex that Argentinians have. I mean, Maradona, for example, in 1993, before the kind of famous Colombia versus Argentina match that Colombia won 5-0, said, you know, Argentina has its history. You know, and history will prevail. You know, it will be Argentina up here because that's where we are, and Colombia will be down there where it belongs. So I suppose that, you know, it should have been Argentina, but because Uruguay had this kind of this smaller neighbour, this kind of slightly more fighting spirit, that and again, you know, Uruguay bases its national identity on that fighting spirit, on this underdog nature that they come up trumps when it really matters. That originates from, you know, 1924, but definitely from 1928 and 1930, when, you know, Uruguay beat Argentina in the Olympics in 1928 and then 1930 in the first World Cup final. So it might just be that. And in that 1930 World Cup, one of the enduring traditions of the need to be masculine, the need to be physical, almost emerges in that game. There was a guy called Monti who was seen as being the hard man of the Argentinian centre-back, who actually ended up playing and winning the 1934 World Cup in Italy. He apparently bottled it. You know, he didn't play with huevas, with masculinity, and was strongly criticised for this. So there's always been this from there, this idea that Argentinian footballers have to show masculinity as well, because when it really mattered, in that first ever World Cup that should have been theirs, they failed. They didn't have that. So I suppose that's some of the reasons. A little bit of failure of organisation, a little bit possibly of not quite, you know, rising to the occasion of that maybe superiority that they thought they just had to turn up and beat their lesser neighbours, because Uruguay is often seen as just being another province of Argentina. Maybe that's why it wasn't Argentina in those first early years that became the great, you know, the nation that really put South American football on the map.
It's strange that, you know, we talk about sliding doors all the time, and, you know, and we look at, you know, we sort of eulogise over that early Uruguayan international side. And I suppose, you know, even myself, before we started on this journey, you know, it's only as we've been talking in this episode, really, that you sort of realise actually how close it could have been, a completely other nation rewriting a completely different history. But for, like you say, the decision not to go, you know, maybe overconfidence or over superiority in a final, you know, there are such fine margins for what is actually ultimately an incredible legacy that's left in the very early stages of international football.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, and again, you know, Gary was talking about these myths, you know, those players are definitely there. One of the things that also grows at the time, and I think that this is why it's you know, a lot of the stories emerge and why football is associated with music and with tango, you know, much like Brazil is associated with samba, that a lot of these early footballers are commemorated in tangos. You know, there are songs sung about the achievements of the players of Boca Juniors and River Plate and Independiente and San Lorenzo and all the other, and Huracán and Racing, you know, the great Racing, the first truly great Argentinian side are Racing, you know, because they're the team that dominates the 1910s as with Argentinian players, and songs are sung about them, further kind of mythologizing these kind of achievements. You know, but it is a real sliding door moment. And again, I suppose that sometimes it's political instability, you know, in South America where for whatever reason there is a civil war or there is a period of military dictatorship or there is a, you know, I mean, in the case of Paraguay, certainly that was the case where they don't develop because of wars. But just at the time where you need money to travel, you know, and maybe it might have been the late 1930s, early 40s. You know, there was a great Argentinian generation there, but that was kind of ruined by the World War. And when it kind of came round afterwards, a few of those players had been kind of poached by European clubs. There was a players' strike, which led to a lot of the players going to Colombia to play in El Dorado. And then Perón wasn't really keen for Argentina to play against other nations because he was worried about Argentinian prestige being lost if they lost. So there was a kind of a potential great generation of Argentinian footballers and maybe dominance that was lost then as well.
It's right. I mean, I think, Gary, as well, from what Pete mentioned, certainly about Monty and the guy who goes to the 34 World Cup, I'm sure he was brought up in the World Cup political podcast series that we did.
He was. I wrote a piece about Monty. It's one of sort of the fascinating quiz questions of football, you know, which player played in successive World Cup finals for two different countries, and it's Luis Monty. And I wrote a piece about him a while ago, and his granddaughter tells a story that Monty said that at half time in the 1930 World Cup final, I think Argentina winning 2-1 at half time in the final, and they were given a message, a letter of some description, some message of communication, some description saying that, you know, if you're going to win this game, your families will suffer. Now, they lost 4-2 in the end. Now, you know, whether that's a plaster to cover the fact that they lost a 2-1 lead and ended up losing 4-2, or it was something that was genuinely true, who can say? But his granddaughter was vehement about it. And 4 years later in Italy, they were playing Italy, and Monty had gone, as was the Arundi, gone to Italy and had been become a nationalised Italian to play for the Azzurri. And at half time in that game, the Azzurri players received a message saying, if you don't win, you're going to suffer. A little bit of irony there, and they won that game. But, you know, Monty's a fascinating subject to study, and I read a fair bit about him. And the reasons he went to Italy, because the game in Argentina was, shall we say, semi-amateur, shall we say, at the time. And he used to work for the local authority to eke out his wages as an Argentinian professional footballer. But so whether he lost the game, Argentina lost the final because they were threatened, or they decided to plaster the reason why they lost the game, who can say?
obviously, we want to get onto the international scene and certainly sort of bringing it a bit more up to date. But I guess, you know, the club scene in Argentina, Pete, is very. It's almost something that I not so much envy, but as a fan of football, it just looks, you know, incredible. It just seems to have this vibrancy and this passion that seems to be almost being lost from the British game.
Yeah, and I think the club scene in Europe, in Argentina, is probably the envy of a lot of South America, primarily because it's so deep rooted, it's so entrenched in the cities and in the suburbs particularly. I think that, again, I kind of mentioned earlier about how the clubs are often originated in the barrio, in the kind of suburb, and they're often these social clubs. That was where you went, you know, you went to meet and you watched the football and you met the neighbourhood and everyone kind of was part of this community. And, you know, and there's, I mean, again, Steve talked about it brilliantly. There are so many great clubs that have such an important identity and a history. You know, it's, and this is an enduring one, but it's not just one or two. I think that this is the sign of a great footballing nation, is that you don't have, you know, two clubs who dominate year after year after year, like Benfica and Porto, for example, and maybe Sporting Lisbon, or, you know, or for example, you know, Bayern Munich and maybe Dortmund or Celtic and Rangers. You know, you have Boca Juniors and River Plate, but you have Racing, you have Estudiantes, you have Independiente, you have, you know, all these great teams that have had really important generations and really important periods where they've been the best in Argentina, and then they've gone on to win the Libertadores, and they've gone on to win, you know, the Suramericana, or they've won the Intercontinental. And I think that also because they've been so entrenched in their communities and their areas, they engender a sense of real loyalty as well. So, you know, people do tend to support the club in which they're brought up. I think probably my only, I mean, it's not really a criticism, is that, but it took so long, I think, for the rest of Argentina to influence Argentinian football in terms of league football. I mean, the Rosario clubs eventually managed to, you know, have an impact. You know, you have clubs like Godoy Cruz now and teams from Tucumán. But, you know, one of the things that I think Argentina possibly hasn't done, and it's just due to the dominance of Buenos Aires, is perhaps have a league that is really representative of the whole country. You know, I mean, maybe that's being very critical, but, you know, I think it's still a very, you know, it's a great league. There are many great clubs with a real sense of tradition, a real sense of history, that are really, you know, cleanly linked with a keen sense of meaning, you know, of stories, of myths, and of real importance for the areas in which they were created, and still do, you know, to this day.
I mean, it's funny, isn't it? I suppose it's probably, you know, the Argentinian League is probably the one that, you know, that certainly British fans, you know, European fans can probably relate to the most. It, you know, it seems almost European in its obsession, and, you know, as Pete said, it's association with community. It's, you know, it's almost the fact that it represents the community that people are from. You know, they live and die the club. You know, it's very much something that, like I say, that British and European fans can relate to.
Yeah, no, I think so. I think that, and it's maybe to do with the kits as well. You know, there are certain kits that have become emblematic. And I think you do hear about these clubs as well. You know, these are clubs that, you know, managed to create an impact on the European stage. I think that's often part of the reason why we don't know many of those players in the 30s and 40s and 50s, because they didn't create an impact in Europe. You know, and we're very European in our nature. We know of, you know, these players in the 40s and 50s and you know, before in our case. But, you know, the great players of Latin America that were around in the 30s, you know, your Ericos of, you know, Paraguay, of Bernabe Ferreira, of, you know, all these kind of players we've talked about, you know, they're superheroes in South American football, but they hadn't really made it over. But then somehow these clubs did. You know, some of these, you know, these Argentinian clubs made it to Europe, played in Europe, became famous in Europe, you know, became famous in the world, because of the impact they were having, the players they were building, you know, managed to create a sense of international impact, which is the true test, I suppose, of the importance of a club, particularly nowadays. Anyway, this kind of global, you know, gaze of who they are. I mean, one of the key ideas of that is the fact that, you know, the Libertadores final between River Plate and Boca Juniors a couple of years ago, you know, when they couldn't play in Argentina because, you know, there was so much animosity. I mean, I was actually in Buenos Aires when the first game happened, and, you know, the whole city started reverberating when it started coming out. You know, the news, the TV was dominated by, they've attacked the bus, this is going to kick off. But the fact that so many cities around the world were desperate to host that game because it was River Plate and because it was Boca Juniors. And it would have been the same, I suspect, if it had been a couple of the other clubs as well, because they do have power. They do have power in our imagination as football clubs with a long-lasting tradition and you know, and a history of great football.
It's, I mean, I suppose, Stephen, it's, you know, this might be something, I guess, that you sort of recognize, as Pete's mentioned there, you know, Boca and River Plate. And obviously, you know, in Liverpool, it's, you know, you can very much relate to, you know, it's a football city. The clubs represent the people, they represent the city, they represent their community. And like I say, it's also helps, but it's also sort of perpetuates why there's this envy, because as as British fans, you can see it and you can relate to it, but they just seem to do it a little bit better than us at the moment.
I think as a Liverpool fan, I think we connect our sense of support. It's not channeled in a British manner. You know, there's almost a, you know, something of a South American tilt to it. Now, if you look at the streets of Liverpool in the wake of winning the Champions League final in 2019, you know, it's the smoke bombs that are drifting across, you know, down the Strand by the Liva building. You know, it's the kids up on the traffic lights. It's the people on the roofs. You know, mad idiots on top of kind of like those scaffolding. There's a brilliant picture of someone. I think he's in his trunks. On top of scaffolding, on a ladder at the top of some scaffolding, and it's not British, you know, and you know, it's just that sense of unfettered passion for your football club, and that it becomes the centre of everything. You know, this is what you somehow represent and you defend, and it is your team. And there's something quite Latin about the way that Liverpool fans match go, and Liverpool fans will support their team. And you know, within that, you know, I think we see, you know, Argentinian supporters in a similar kind of fashion. So we kind of get where it comes from. We get that all-encompassing passion. You know, we see the stuff that goes on, and we smile. You know, because it's just there's a common theme to it. You know, we know how that feels, and it's a brilliant thing. So, yes, when this you know, amazing Copa Libertadores final, you know, dawned, you know, this, I don't know, kind of like magnetic pull towards some sense of impending doom, you know, could fully understand it, because at the end of the day, this is the biggest game between the biggest arrivals, and someone had to lose. And that sense of foreboding, that sense of dread of being the team to lose, must have been astronomical. I mean, I can't imagine. You know, it's like imagining a, you know, a Champions League final between Liverpool, Manchester United, or Real Madrid and Barcelona. You know, there is forever going to be not just the glory of winning, but the bragging rights of who you've just beaten. You know, it's all of that. So we don't completely get the passion and the vibrancy of it all, and this all-encompassing obsession.
It's typified. I mean, you know, these Football Times magazines, I think it's 12 club issues we've done now. You know, and two, you know, and Boca and River Plate are two of those magazines. You know, so when, you know, as Pete's mentioned about stories and players, you know, clearly it's something that Omar and ourselves have identified as being, you know, a place. You know, a place for football stories.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, the word is passion, as Stephen mentioned there. You know, when you look at, you know, our contributed articles, both those magazines, when you sort of do a little research and you put pictures up, there's the players climbing the fences after they've scored, and they're 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 foot in the air, and the fans are climbing there as well on the other side. It's I think, you know, passion is the right word. I mean, you know, there's waves of euphoria tiding their ways down from the stadium, from the terracing to the players on the pitch. And, you know, winning is not the most important thing. Winning is the only thing. You know, if you're coming second, you're last, and you know, that's not great. That's not great, because you're going to get taunted forever. And you know, when you get your rivals like Boca and River Plate, you know, in the same city. I mean, when it's a little bit more distant, I suppose there's a chance for it to dissipate a bit. When you're in the same city, you know, the rivalry between that, and you know, you get Liverpool, Everton, where Stevie is, but that's not. I mean, you know, they want to win, but there's not that sort of what's the word I'm looking for? Almost ethnic hatred between the two. Well, social hatred, but it's perhaps a better way of putting it, between the two clubs. And you know, when you win, you're going to dine out forever. And, you know, the guys who score the winning goals in those games are fated for until the next game, at least.
You know, I guess, you know, we need to sort of move on to the international scene and sort of bring it a bit more up to date, Pete. And it's, in Argentina have this golden, well, as Steve mentioned, I don't want to call it tarnished gold, but ultimately they're golden moments. They're world champions, and that's what it is. That's what the record books show. But sort of, you know, we mentioned, you know, they come close in 30, but then it gets right up to 78, you know, and they win it in 78. They win it again in 86. They make the final in 90. You know, there's three World Cup finals in four tournaments. And then it all goes quiet again, and, you know, it's 2014. And it's, I don't, you know, Argentina do have this massive reputation for international success. And yet when you look at it in the cold light of day, it's within a very condensed period of time.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, they haven't won the Copa America in 27 years, which is unthinkable. You know, I mean, you think 27 years and Argentina haven't won the Copa America. I mean, that doesn't seem right. And it is, it's not an amazing record. I suppose that one of the reasons, I guess, for that is that you've obviously got the benefits of the home World Cup and, you know, and the slight, you know, the favourable pressures that might have contributed to certain victories against Peru, you know, and the pressures of playing under a military dictatorship. But, you know, I mean, it was a good side, you know, maybe not as good as you know, the Dutch sides, I'm sure Gary will argue, but, you know, but it was a good side. But then you have this bloke called Maradona who you know, knew how to play, and, you know, he almost kind of carries the nation on his shoulders. You know, I suppose that, you know, I mean, we were going to talk about Maradona anyway, but one of the things that is so important about him is that he crystallizes, you know, the myths of what Argentinian footballers should be, the style of what Argentinian footballers should be. You know, this, you know, he comes from, you know, this kind of Villa Miseria, kind of a shanty town effectively, and is seen, you know, as being this natural force. And then he it's not associated with the military junta, because the 1978 World Cup is a massive moment, but the 86 is almost bigger, because, you know, it's not in Argentina and we don't have a dictatorship. We won it in Mexico. You know, we beat everyone. You know, some guy scored the greatest, most famous goal the world's ever seen. And we were the world champions and no one could take that away from us. And we also had the greatest player, arguably, the world's ever seen. So I suppose that, you know, there is such an importance placed on Maradona at that moment. And he kind of almost carries not only the team, you know, a good team. You know, you've got the likes of Burruchaga and, you know, and Brown and Ruggeri. You know, you've got some good players there, but he carries them. And he carries, you know, the nation and also that particular team. And I think that, you know, what you often have then after that is that you have this pressure. You have a pressure to somehow, first of all, relinquish the Maradona memory. And almost Maradona carries on too long. There's, you know, not only as a player, but then as a manager. You know, and he's a terrible manager. You know, almost everything Maradona does after he stops playing is a failure in lots of ways. But you kind of, there is a difficulty in relinquishing what Maradona was. And then there's always too much pressure placed on the likes of Aymar, Ortega, Riquelme, and this new generation that have to somehow conform to this. And you also have this constant battle of how is the best way to play? Do we do La Nuestra? Do we play in our style, this passing fluidity, short passing, invention, individuality? Or do we play, you know, the physical way, the modern way, the kind of more technical, hard way? You know, there's this kind of battle for Argentinian soul that's often been talked about as being Menotti against Bilardo's football, but also kind of goes back to the Zubeldia football and then goes back to the 1950s before that about what Argentinian football was. And I think that those particular issues, you know, a lack of consistency in approach, you know, somehow not quite managing to get it all together when it really mattered, not having the right coach, not having a couple of key players, about suddenly almost all the attention being put on the 10 as being the person who is going to win it, almost kind of means that Argentina don't quite, you know, achieve or don't have that consistency of continued success that they probably should have had. There are obviously other reasons as well. There's a lot of great football teams in the world. But I think, you know, Argentina, maybe because they see themselves and they've got this expectation of we should win, we should be in the final every time. That kind of pressure, that kind of weight of social expectations often kind of, you know, creates a weight that some of the players haven't really been able to overcome. I mean, it's like you look at Messi, and I always think when Messi's played in the last kind of, you know, maybe 8 years for Argentina, it's almost like there's a hunch. It's almost like there's, you know, a general, you know, history of tens and football players weighing on him. And then all the people in Latin America, in Argentina, but potentially Latin America, all leaning on him as well. So, I mean, maybe that's why they haven't quite achieved what they possibly could have done. This, maybe that's why they've had these kind of, you know, peaks and troughs, or not troughs, but just times where they haven't really got beyond the second round when they really should have.
I'm going to ask you a question soon, based on all the stuff that Pete just said there. So between you know, the 78 and 86 team, you know, they're both world champions, 78-86. For you, which is the better team?
Better team, 78. It's a more balanced side. There's a lot more talent across the board. I think the 86 side is damned by this concept that Maradona won the World Cup single-handedly. He didn't. You know, it was a team with some very good players in there, but the point being, if you take Maradona out of that side in 86, then it's unlikely to win that World Cup. I think if you took any player, including Kempes, out of the 78 side, somehow they still come through. There's someone else that steps in to fill the breach. I think Maradona is someone, there is no filling that breach if he is missing. So across the board, 78's a better side, but it's damned by where they win the World Cup, the ambiguity of the regime, all the stories of the Peru game. You know, there's a lack of fortune there. You know, you can listen to our dealers talk about that World Cup and say that they knew nothing of what was going on. They were just there to play the football, and you know, and it sounds totally plausible. You know, they you know, these are people who have played game professionally in what are seen to be fairer lands almost. So they've come to England, they've played for Tottenham. You know, he went and played for PSG for a while. There's no reason for him to not be bluntly honest if there was something going on behind the scenes in 78. But no, as far as the teams are concerned, that 78 side is so much better. There's a massive amount of talent in that side.
To be fair, I would actually agree with that. In terms of a team, I would agree with that. Gary, I'm not going to ask you if Maradona's the greatest player that's ever played the game. But In terms of, it's interesting what Pete mentioned there, and that's the sort of, you know, the weight of expectation, the burden of the number 10 shirt. And you sort of look at Pelé's retirement after 1970 and the weight of expectation that was placed on that Brazilian shirt for all the people who would come afterwards, that you would always be judged against those performances by Pelé's record. And I suppose the same is happening, or has happened, in Argentina based on Maradona's achievements in 86.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Perhaps only Zico ever really came close to doing sufficient homage to the 10 shirt. And, you know, I mean, wearing the shirt that Maradona wore, my God, that's a challenge in half, isn't it, really? That's a proper challenge. I mean, you know, and it's something that perhaps Messi has struggled with. You know, he didn't have the great players around him. I mean, I wouldn't say Messi didn't have the great players. He had, you know, Valdano and Gonzaga, Ruggeri, as Pete mentioned, which were, you know, they were a more than decent team. By the way, 78 team should have lost to the Dutch. Second best team.
I didn't ask if they were the best team in the tournament.
I'm just throwing that in there. I know you didn't ask it, but you get that for free. Not sure. but yeah, it's a massive pressure, and you know, it's something that Messi never seems to have been able to shake off. You know, the guy who plays for Barcelona, although let's lose the last couple of seasons because Barcelona have been pretty damn poor over here. And Messi, when Messi doesn't play well, Barcelona doesn't play well. But you know, in the perhaps look, it's going back to when he was in his late 20s and getting towards 30. You know, and probably was the best player in the world, except when he put an Argentina shirt and always came up a little bit short. And it may be that weight that Pete mentioned, with, you know, the pressure and so many people in South America leaning on him and expecting him, hoping for him, desiring him, needing him to deliver for them, was just too much.
Do you think, Gary, that will ultimately weigh on when, you know, when we have this discussion about the greatest players who ever played the game, and it's Pelé, it's Cruyff, it's Maradona, and you know, in terms of Messi's sort of throwing his hat into the ring, for want of a better word, or when his, you know, when his legacy and his career is evaluated, that lack of success on the international stage, will it always keep him in that sort of lower bracket, if you like?
I don't know. It's one of these things when, you know, people say, "Oh, so and so is the best player in the world." How do you judge these things? You know, Pelé won 3 World Cups, Maradona won 2, Cruyff never won one. George Best never even played in a World Cup tournament. You know, so it's difficult to sort of, you know, you pick a criteria based on the player that you want to justify.
Yeah.
It's true. You do. I don't mean you do, Stu, but generally there's a tendency for that to happen. And, you know, Messi, apparently when he scored against Valencia on, I want to say Wednesday, it might be Tuesday, equaled Pelé's record for the most goals scored for a single club, and he's going to score a few more before he retires, that's for sure. Does that make him the greatest player? Probably not, unless you want to say that Messi's the greatest player, in which case you can use that as an argument.
what a great answer. Guys, we've sort of, you know, we're well over an hour here, but obviously we can't let this go. Based on everything that we've talked about, I've just had another idea, actually. I'm going to ask questions. No, it's all right. It's all right. I'm going to ask you two questions. Don't worry about it. So first question is, obviously, either favourite, best Argentinian player, you know, who are you picking? You have all of history to choose from. You know, Pete's given us some great names from the past. Obviously, we've talked about Maradona just now. We've talked about Lionel Messi. You know, in terms of countries and great players, this one has had its fair share. Steve, we'll start with you first, I think.
I'm going to go for two, actually, because I know that neither Pete or Gary are going to go down the Maradona route, but you can't not go down the Maradona route because he was just, you know, whether you want to call him the best player ever or not, undeniably unique and so dominant at the peak of his powers, hypnotic with the ball. Doing the magazine that we're putting together on Maradona, I had the joy of writing about his Napoli days. And, you know, the article kind of starts with that epic warm-up against Bayern Munich and to the theme tune, the overdubbed theme tune of Opus's Live is Life. And, you know, that is pretty much the theme of the article, because it starts with the man at the peak of his powers, at the happiest he's ever been, I think. And he was just football. You know, he was purely football. You strip away all of his demons. You just gave him a ball. That was what you saw, that warm-up prior to the Bayern Munich game, the second leg of the UEFA Cup semi-final in 89. And I don't think there's a finer sight in a footballing context during, you know, prior to a game. You know, something revolving around a football match that isn't involved within the football match itself, within the 90 minutes or the 120 minutes or the penalty shootout. So I don't think there's a finer image than that warm-up that Maradona did at the Olympia Stadium. No, it was just astronomical. It's you know, it's disco dancing football. You know, it's just absolutely phenomenal. And I could watch it over and over and over again. Beyond Maradona, I would throw in Angel Bruna, who I wrote about quite a bit in the River Plate magazine, part of the machine, the Macquina, scored an absolutely obscene amount of goals in winning so many, you know, trophies with River. Went to the World Cup nearly at the age of 40 in 1958, came back to the club as coach in the mid-1970s at a time when they hadn't won anything for 18 years and built this new empirical era of success for the club. Found it, knew little about him before I delved into the history of the club and all the research, but I was just transfixed by this figure that was so important both as a player and as a coach. And prior to going back to River as coach, he'd won the title, the domestic title with Rosario Central, no mean feat in 71, and just incredible character. Came so close to winning that first Libertadores for them as well, that just ran away from them. But he laid the groundwork for them to go on and win the Libertadores a few years after his death.
Okay, good start. Gary, we'll come to you next.
Okay, well, I'm not going to go for the best Argentine player, but my favourite Argentine player, and it's one that's not been mentioned today at all, it's Hernán Crespo. Crespo came to Chelsea, was part of the first sort of tranche of world stars that joined the club. And I think he was 30 at the time, and he played in so many great clubs and never won a league title. And he won the title with Chelsea in 2005-2006. And there's a fantastic picture of him sitting in the dressing room after the medal's been awarded, looking at his medals with tears in his eyes. And that always sort of touched me. And there's the other part that makes me sort of, you know, think fondly of Press Bowie is that he related the story that when he was a child, he was sitting on the doorstep waiting for the rubbish man coming around. I think it was, you know, in Buenos Aires, to take the bins away, the rubbish away from the houses. And he only wanted to be one of two things. He either wanted to be a bin man or a professional footballer. Fortunately for Chelsea, he chose the latter. So, Aaron Crespo will do for me.
A surprising choice, I've got to say. Pete, you've now got anyone else that you want to pick from?
Yeah, I mean, if you were to say the players that I've most enjoyed watching from Argentina, Messi, obviously, and Riquelme would be up there as well. There's a certain poetry, there's a certain grace, there's a certain flair that you kind of just enjoy watching. I mean, I'd probably rather watch both than Matt Letizia, and that's the highest praise you can possibly give any player. I mean, I think that, you know, over this series, you know, I suppose my role has slightly been the historian role. So I'm going to pick two from history from further back that hopefully people might not know about. The first one is another guy from La Máquina that Steve mentioned. I'm going to say he's picked the wrong one, although La Bruna is a great shout, phenomenal player, you know, perfectly valid choice. Probably a better player in that team was a guy called José Manuel Moreno, known as El Charro. He was the first player to win four league championships in four different countries, I think, in the world. You know, I think it was in Argentina for River Plate, in Colombia for Medellin, in Chile for I think it was Universidad Católica, Universidad de Chile, and I've forgotten the team in Mexico, which gave him the Charro nickname. Again, he was the kind of the charismatic stylist, the dilettante, the guy that was, you know, that trained by dancing pango. He said that the worst he'd ever played was the night they'd made him drink milk rather than, you know, alcohol. He was suspended a huge amount of times for his less than professional behaviour, but apparently Maradona was embarrassed to have been said that he was the best Argentinian player ever rather than ahead of El Charro Moreno. There's a list of, in 1999, there was a list of the greatest ever South American players. You know, you have Pelé, you have Maradona, you have Di Stefano, who, again, is my second great player. You have Garrincha. And then the fifth is Moreno, which is huge praise in a continent that's produced so many stars. And I think it's a little bit, it's almost inconceivable to have gone, have an hour and 20 minutes without having talked about Alfredo Di Stefano, the Saeta Rubia, the kind of the blonde arrow who, you know, almost became the first great transfer story that, you know, the first kind of conflict between Barcelona and Real Madrid. You know, the Argentinian that was picked by Adolfo Pedernera, another great player of that Máquina team of the 1950s, to go and play in Colombia and absolutely dominated that Millonarios team, the blue ballet that put Colombian football on the map, and then went across to Spain, beat Real Madrid 4-2, and then Di Stefano became this tug-of-war figure between Barcelona and Real Madrid. And again, an amazing player. You know, it's a tragedy that there isn't more video of the likes of these players. But, you know, in the interest of history, they're the two players that I'm going to put forward humbly as being my choices. Since Steve had two, I thought I'd nick two as well.
nothing wrong with that. It's the last episode. Why not? So to finish with then, guys, based on Gary's sort of earlier statement that you can make the greatest fit whatever criteria you want, I've decided against the greatest. Who is your, and I only want the name, I don't need anything else, your most favourite South American footballer? I'll give Lewis 10 seconds to edit out. So your favourite South American, which I guess the criteria here is to watch. Is what I'm going to say. So I'm not after the greatest. I'm not after the best. I'm just after the whole of the continent of South America. Who is your... It's the last one. We're at the end of the journey. We've been around the block. Who is your all-time favourite South American footballer to watch play the game? Who would like it first? Go on, Gary. Well done.
One word. Four letters. First letter, per. Third letter, L-A.
Okay. That'll do for me. Stephen?
I'm going to go for a compatriot of Pelé's. I'm opting for Garrincha. You're fascinated by him since I very first heard of him. You know, what little footage there is, you know, is stunning. And he is just a physical anomaly as part of that.
Okay, and I guess it's only right then, Pete. We sort of started with you. We've learned from you. You can finish us off with, for you, who is your all-time favourite South American footballer?
Garrincha is up there. There's a joy of looking back at old videos. There really is. I think that I'm going to go, because I'm a Colombianist, it would be rude not to go Colombia. Valderrama was a genius. But actually, the guy that was somehow just so thrilling and so utterly South American, you know, who kind of encapsulates this madness, this incredible genius, this passion, this idiocy, you know, is probably Faustino Asprilla. I mean, you know, and again, you pick the, you know, there's something about, I mean, if I was to pick any game, you know, from South America that I'd want to watch over and over again, it would be the Colombia 5, Argentina 0. And I want to have the Colombian commentator and I want to hear him going absolutely nuts. And I want to know that every single person in Colombia is either screaming or crying or laughing with joy, particularly when Asprilla kind of scores the fourth goal of the five. You know, he kind of, you know, gets down the wing and then just chips it, curls it into the top corner, kind of, you know, ambles off languidly, does his kind of somersault thing, punches the ground, gets submerged by all the players. The commentator's asking the president to give everyone a national holiday, weeping with joy, you know, this salsa music. For that moment and what Asprilla could, when he could be bothered or when everything seemed to collide, you know, he seemed to become, you know, what possibly the encapsulation of the glory of South American football sometimes can be. And what it also, unfortunately, also is as well. So, yeah, for that reason, I'm going to go Asprilla.
What a perfect way to finish, finish the series. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Guys, it's been, like I say, I've had the best seat in the house. I just get to think of things, and whatever I want to know, I can just ask, and it's as simple as that. Gary, enjoyed the series?
Yeah, it's been fantastic. You know, you kind of go like Pete and not learn so much about whatever the subject we're talking about, particularly South American football, which is such a hotbed of football and, you know, so important to the development of the game. And, you know, without sort of dropping too much of a spoiler here, you know, Pete's going to come back next year and talk to us in a new series going to be developing about South American football. So, you know, if you've enjoyed this series, the next one's going to be an absolute blinder. So, you know, massive thanks to Pete for all his expertise, knowledge, patience with our inquisitiveness about South American football and the school days he's given us. So, massive thanks, Pete, and look forward to next time, buddy.
Stephen, I'm, you know, without a doubt, we say, you know, South American football, it's, you know, it's again, it's one of the reasons why we love football. You know, Pete said it far better than I can, but it's just bonkers. It's beautiful. It's brutal. It's everything.
Oh, it's totally everything, and it's the contrast against European football as well. You know, it's like, you know, Beatles and the Stones. It's whichever contrast you want to put up there. You know, you're meant to like one or the other. You know what, it's all right to like both and to love both, and I certainly do.
Like I said, Pete, it has been an absolute pleasure. I feel like these should all be done, sealed up in a box set and sold to secondary schools for political and, you know, if tutors are looking, especially for online learning, if they're looking for history, politics, whatever you want in terms of lessons, these should all be parceled up and sent out. Like Gary said, I've learned so much. It's just been fascinating to listen to you.
No, it's just a joy being part of these conversations. You know, I think let's not forget what Steve and Gary, you know, add in. You know, there's a lot of football knowledge, a lot of football experience. They've watched the game, you know, longer than I have, as much, you know, they've studied the game, they've written about the game as well. It's just a joy to be part of these podcasts and these conversations and you know, listen to their opinions as well. You get a huge amount from pinging ideas off and building on what they've said as well. So no, it's just, thanks very much for inviting me on. It's great fun today. It's been a real highlight of the kind of summer and autumn and winter of 2020, hasn't it? So no, thanks very much. It's been really good fun.
I can't believe it's taken us three seasons to get through it, but that's okay. obviously, all that's left for me to say is, you know, is thank you to everybody who's watched and listened. Obviously, thanks to the guys. You know, that concludes this series. But as Gary's left us with a little season two teaser trailer right at the end, obviously keep a look and a listen out for something in the new year. And thank you for listening, and please join us again next time. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on The Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.